Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 16th, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has a kind of a grayed out whitish background and shows a woman sitting on the ground cross-legged. She's got a blanket wrapped around her shoulders and you can't see her face. She's got her head down in her hands. She's sitting in front of one of these makeshift memorials that's a mound of flowers. The title of the cover is spelled out. The letters are spelled out with different kinds of guns, shotguns, rifles, handguns, automatic weapons. And it spells out the words white nationalism. The subtitle is America's Growing Terrorist Threat. And that is our first main story. American carnage in Texas and Ohio. What happened? The nation was thrust into a fraught national reckoning on guns, white nationalism, and domestic terrorism this week after at least 31 people were killed and dozens more wounded in mass shootings in Texas and Ohio. In El Paso, 21-year-old Patrick Crucius shot and killed 22 people and wounded 26 others with a semi-automatic rifle inside a crowded Walmart before surrendering to police. Just before driving from an affluent Dallas suburb to commit the shooting, the gunman posted a racist manifesto on 8chan, a message board frequented by white supremacists, in which he said the attack was a response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas and open borders, and the Democrats' attempt to enact a political coup by importing and then legalizing millions of new voters. This was an echo of President Trump's frequent rhetoric about the influx of Central American migrants at the border, but the shooter said he developed his anti-immigrant views before Trump. Less than 15 hours later in Dayton, 24-year-old Connor Betts used an AR-15 to kill 9 people and wound 27 outside a bar in a popular nightlife area in a rampage that lasted only 30 seconds before he was killed by police. The shooter's sister was among the victims. A self-declared leftist on social media, the gunman had a history of threatening women and kept a hit list of people he wanted to kill or rape, acquaintances said. One of the gunman's ex-girlfriends said he was obsessed with mass shootings and told her that he heard voices and wanted to, quote, hurt a lot of people. President Trump visited Dayton and El Paso in the aftermath of the shootings, where he faced protest for his opposition to gun control and his anti-immigration rhetoric. Representative Veronica Escobar, a Democrat from Texas, a Hispanic congresswoman who represents the El Paso area, said Trump was not welcome in her city. Words have consequences, and the president has made my community and my people the enemy, Escobar said. What the editorial said, white nationalist terrorism is a serious and growing reality, said the Los Angeles Times. According to the Anti-Defamation League, 73.3% of all extremist-related deaths in the U.S. over the past decade have been linked to right-wing terrorists like the El Paso shooter. In a televised speech he read off a teleprompter, President Trump belatedly called on Americans to condemn white supremacy and hatred. He should start with himself. Trump has been fanning the flames of division for years, and while the El Paso gunman may have learned to view Hispanic immigration as an infestation of vermin from online cesspools, Trump has legitimized that bigotry and brought it into the mainstream. What about the Dayton shooter, asked the Wall Street Journal. The mass murderer in Ohio appears to have had leftist politics. More importantly, he was a deeply disturbed man who was allegedly obsessed with mass shootings and openly fantasized about committing violence. The twisted motivations of mass killers are varied and often too convoluted to sort into any clear ideology. The common thread is that both the El Paso and Dayton shooters were angry, isolated young men who felt alienated in our increasingly atomistic culture. Blaming individual politicians or ideologies is pointless and counterproductive. What the columnist said, there are disturbing parallels between radical Islam and white nationalism, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. Just like followers of ISIS and other Islamist terror groups, white supremacists are obsessed with purity and use social media to spread their agenda, radicalize others, and celebrate terrorist acts. Imagine how the country would have responded if the El Paso shooter had labeled himself a jihadist, said David French in NationalReview.com. Law enforcement needs the resources and the mandate to pursue racist radicals with the same intensity as ISIS. It's time to declare war on white nationalist terrorism. That will never happen while Trump is in office, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The Trump administration has slashed millions of dollars in funding dedicated to monitoring and combating white supremacist terrorism while signaling to Justice Department employees that such efforts would be unwelcome. A former FBI supervisor said agents feel reluctant to investigate groups and individuals that the president perceives as his base. Meanwhile, Trump has done more than anyone to mainstream white nationalist tropes, and he probably couldn't bottle up the hideous forces he's helped unleash, even if he wanted to. It's not just Trump, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. Right-wing media increasingly traffics in white nationalist talking points. Fox News' Tucker Carlson, who declared this week that the threat of white supremacy is a hoax, regularly depicts the browning of America through immigration as a dire threat. Laura Ingraham has told viewers that Democrats want to replace you with illegal immigrants, a version of the Great Replacement conspiracy theory embraced by the El Paso shooter. America, we have a serious white supremacy problem. We're going to read the second main story this week, titled Growing Trade War with China Puts Economy at Risk. What happened? President Trump slapped a fresh round of tariffs on Chinese exports last week, escalating his year-long trade war and roiling global markets, after China showed little sign of softening in the latest round of talks. Trump said the U.S. would impose a 10% duty on another $300 billion in Chinese exports on September 1st, adding to 25% tariffs already levied on $250 billion in goods. The announcement came one day after U.S. negotiators returned from fruitless talks in Shanghai, and Trump castigated China for breaking a promise to buy American farm products. He claims Chinese President Xi Jinping made in June. That is the problem with China. They just don't come through, Trump tweeted. China responded by devaluing the yuan to its lowest level against the dollar since 2008 and vowing to halt American farm imports while also taxing those recently purchased. The effects of the new tariffs could quickly become apparent in stores. 62% of the products slated for tariffs are consumer goods, including apparel and footwear, toys, and cell phones. By one estimate, the cost of an iPhone will jump $75 to $100. Stocks retreated globally on the news, including a 2.9% tumble in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That was the index's worst single-day performance since December 24th, as investors braced for the possibility of a protracted global slump. In the U.S., Moody's Analytics raised the chances of recession over the next year to 50% from 35%. Trump's tariffs came one day after the Federal Reserve cut interest rates for the first time since 2008. Partly, Chairman Jerome Powell said, in response to downside risks from trade tensions. What the editorials said. Trump's latest tariff salvo is no more likely to produce a deal than previous rounds, said Bloomberg.com. The pain of the levies is primarily felt not by China, but by U.S. consumers shouldering higher costs and manufacturers who must overhaul intricate supply chains. Moreover, Trump's unreasonable demands have unwisely painted any prospective compromise as a Chinese surrender. He would have done better to find ways to give China an out and spend concessions as being in China's interest. Trump's trade war has now become a currency war, said the Wall Street Journal. After China devalued the yuan, the U.S. Treasury Department branded China a currency manipulator, a provocative designation that can trigger still more tariffs. Global markets tanked. Any further devaluation could trigger a debt crisis among Chinese companies that must service hundreds of billions of dollars in debts with a devalued yuan. If China's economy plunges into recession, it will end badly for everyone. What the columnist said. This trade war is pushing us into what former Treasury Secretary Larry Summer calls the most dangerous financial moment since the 2009 financial crisis, said Heather Long in the Washington Post. The consensus on Wall Street is that it's going to get worse before it gets better. U.S. economic growth has already cooled to a 2% pace. Now the tariffs dampen the prospects even more, and the bond market is signaling a coming recession. Ironically, the market's stumble over China and the weakening economy could give Trump the rate cut he wants from the Fed, said Shuli Ren in Bloomberg.com. Trump used the yuan devaluation as a cudgel to berate the Fed and push for lower interest rates. As Beijing well knows, sometimes a leader's belligerence toward other nations is really aimed at an audience at home. Trump is fighting the right fight at the right time, said Salvatore Baboni in nationalinterest.com. China is feeling real pain as manufacturers flee to Vietnam and India, while the American economy employs record numbers of people. Over time, China will only become stronger, and protecting American intellectual property will be more difficult. If 1989 was the historical moment to squeeze the Soviet Union, then 2019 is the historical moment to squeeze China. With his latest gambit, Trump is jeopardizing his chances in 2020, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. His staunch red state supporters took another blow when China vowed to stop buying U.S. agricultural products. With a suicidal trade war, Trump eliminates the sole rationale for his reelection, the economic recovery. Our controversy of the week is titled, Guns, Will Any New Laws Make a Difference? The epidemic of mass shootings in America is really not a complicated problem to puzzle out, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. In statements after last weekend's back-to-back massacres by young men armed with weapons of war, President Trump and other Republicans variously blamed the phenomena on mental illness, video games, declining religiosity, hatred, and evil. But these same problems exist in other developed nations, and yet it's only in America that citizens are shot to death in mass with numbing regularity. The Japanese, for example, spend far more per capita on video games, but average fewer than 10 gun deaths a year, compared with our 40,000. What's different about our country? Simple. This is the only developed nation where it is not only legal, but easy and convenient to amass a private arsenal of mass slaughter. That needs to change, said the New York Post in an editorial, starting with a reimposition of an assault weapons ban. We can't stop all disaffected young men from venting their rage on innocent civilians, but at least we can take away the murder machines that let them rack up such horrific body counts. There is no such thing as an assault weapon, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. The AR-15 and AK-47 used in Dayton and El Paso, respectively, have the same rate of fire and are only cosmetically different from every other semi-automatic rifle on sale in the U.S., including most hunting rifles. The AR-15 has become the most popular rifle in America, with up to 15 million in private hands, and the Supreme Court has ruled that the Second Amendment protects weapons that are in common use. The reality is that every gun is designed to kill, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. Short of mass confiscation of 300 million guns already in circulation, which isn't going to happen, no law is going to stop a determined madman or terrorist from obtaining a weapon and fulfilling his bloody fantasies. It's true that no law can legislate the crazies and truly evil out of existence, said Scott Jennings, former advisor to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, in the Louisville Courier-Journal. But there are common sense measures that would make a difference. A ban on high-capacity magazines, in particular, would force mass shooters to stop and reload, giving police a better chance to end their rampages. In Dayton, the shooter used a 100-round drum that enabled him to fire 41 rounds in just 30 seconds. Both gun owners and gun control advocates can support red flag laws, said David French in NationalReview.com, which would let authorities seize the guns of the dangerously mentally ill, domestic abusers, and people exhibiting threatening behavior. If properly drafted to ensure due process, such laws can remove firearms from people who have demonstrated by their own conduct that they are not fit to own a weapon. This grieving nation shouldn't expect much change, said Jill Lawrence in USA Today. Republicans don't dare jeopardize their political identities as the people who let you keep your guns, any kind you want, as many as you want, with magazines as big as you want. Such absolutism may no longer be a political winner, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com. The once powerful NRA is riven by scandal and is losing its clout, while Republicans are worried that their slavish opposition to gun control is alienating millions of suburban moderates. A growing number of Americans are frightened and utterly disgusted by the carnage and will no longer settle for politicians' thoughts and prayers. Well, maybe we'll have some lighter news in our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Starting with, it was a good week for openness. After, in a lavish ceremony, Thailand's King Maha, age 67, elevated his mistress, age 34, to the role of official concubine with his wife, Queen Sudita, sitting expressionless at his side. It was a good week for extraterrestrial life, with news that the private Israeli spacecraft that crashed into the moon this April was carrying a cargo of dehydrated tardigrades, or water bears, microscopic animals able to survive up to 10 years without water or oxygen. And it was a good week for right sizing after a New Jersey school district eliminated the $141,000 a year position of principal rather than lay off teachers or other administrators. "We did something like this a few years ago," said a school board official, "and it worked out." But it was a bad week for senior moments when, in the wake of the massacres in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, President Trump, 73, referred to those who perished in Toledo, while Joe Biden, 76, lamented the tragic events in Houston today and also in Michigan the day before. It was a bad week for Germans who were being kept awake in large numbers by louder-than-usual hedgehog mating season. Hedgehogs snarl loudly during the hours-long mating ritual, a hedgehog expert in Munich explained, and the males make the most noise. And finally, it was a bad week for unplanned pregnancies. After former Ohio University basketball star DJ Cooper, 28, was banned for 2 years from European leagues because he failed a drug test. Cooper's urine indicated that he was either pregnant himself or had borrowed a urine sample from his pregnant girlfriend. On the briefing page, we have Britain's unlikely prime minister. Boris Johnson has finally achieved his dream of moving into 10 Downing Street. How did he get there? Who is Boris Johnson? Husky and blonde, he's a larger-than-life character who spouts Shakespeare and Latin but can't seem to comb his unruly hair or arrive anywhere on time. An Eton and Oxford-educated Tory, Johnson, 55, is hardly the stereotype of a buttoned-up conservative. Twice divorced with four kids by the wife he left last year, he has another child out of wedlock, and at least one of his mistresses had an abortion. When he moved into 10 Downing Street last week, he brought his current flame, the PR agent Carrie Simons, 31, and the two became the first unmarried couple ever to live in the prime minister's residence. A brilliant and wildly entertaining writer and speaker, Johnson has been a columnist, member of parliament, mayor of London, and foreign minister. Yet his policy achievements are thin. The British regard him either as a buffoon or as a refreshing rebel against political correctness. He has written of African pickaninnies with watermelon smiles, and said Muslim women in burqas look like letterboxes. Yet no matter his sins, he always manages to get a pass. What are his origins? Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson was born in New York City into a competitive, intellectual English family of five siblings. His part Turkish father was a European Commission bureaucrat and novelist who moved the family to Brussels, where the bright young Al Johnson spent a largely unhappy childhood. Always ambitious, he once told his sister that he intended to become king of the world. At Eton, Al reinvented himself as Boris and began to develop his clownish persona of a bumbling yet lovable rogue, witty and self-deprecating. By his university years at Oxford, where he was a member of the raucous, hard-drinking Bullingdon Club and head of the Oxford Union Debating Society, he had developed a worshipful obsession with Winston Churchill, the journalist turned prime minister he believes he is destined to emulate. How did he get his start? Family connections placed Johnston at the prestigious Times in 1987, but he was fired after just a few months for inventing a quote. The conservative Daily Telegraph, though, made him its European Union correspondent in Brussels at age 24. Johnson livened up the dull post by making up outrageous stories about EU bureaucracy, taking obscure memos and presenting them as actual EU policy. He claimed that snails would be classified as fish, that two curvy bananas would be banned, and that condom size would be standardized, and the Italians wanted smaller ones. His first wife said he would file stories with foreign datelines when he hadn't left their flat. Boris is very charming, very plausible, but cuts fast and loose with the facts, says the Cambridge Classics professor Mary Beard. His hilarious reports stirred up resentment of the EU across the UK. When did he turn to politics? In the late 90s, he became a national celebrity as a panelist on the comedy show Have I Got News for You, charming audiences with droll self-mockery. In 2001, while serving as an editor of the right-wing Spectator magazine, Johnson was elected to Parliament. In 2008 and 2012, the Conservative was twice elected mayor of Liberal London, largely on charisma. He was an effective cheerleader for the global city, particularly during the run-up to the 2012 Olympic Games, when he memorably got stuck dangling from a zip line, waving little Union Jacks. Why did he champion Brexit? During the campaign leading up to the 2016 referendum on leaving the EU, Johnson recognized that many Britons felt deep resentment over the erosion of national identity and unimpeded influx of foreign labor. So he abandoned his pro-Europe, pro-immigration mayoral persona and broke with his party leader, then Prime Minister David Cameron, to become the face of Vote Leave. Johnson's a political chameleon, says his biographer, Sonia Purnell. There are no core beliefs, no values, just instincts. He toured the country in a bus emblazoned with the lie that the UK would save £350 million, then $525 million, a week, all going to shore up the National Health Service. But when Leave won and Cameron resigned, Johnson appeared shocked and paralyzed. He withdrew from the running for Prime Minister and compromised candidate Theresa May won. May surprised many by appointing him as Foreign Minister, and Johnson made a mess of it. What did he do wrong? He was a bull in the diplomatic china shop. Johnson offended the French by comparing then-President Francois Hollande to a Nazi prison guard and the Burmese by reciting a colonial-era Rudyard Kipling poem. He constantly criticized May's Brexit negotiations with Brussels, and when she presented a deal that would keep the UK closely bound to the EU, he resigned in protest. That stance positioned him as the hard Brexit favorite to succeed May when she resigned without an agreement last month. With his Brexit advocacy, Johnson created the greatest constitutional crisis in peacetime in my life, said Tory politician Michael Heseltine. Now it's up to him to resolve it. Boris's Brexit promises. Irrepressibly confident, Johnson insists that he will renegotiate a deal with Brussels that gets rid of the dreaded Irish backstop. This is the provision that requires the UK to stay in the EU customs union as long as necessary to avoid a hard border between EU member Ireland and the UK region Northern Ireland. The EU says May's deal can't be changed, but Johnson has always refused hard choices. My policy on cake, he once said, is pro-having it and pro-eating it. If there is no deal, Johnson says, he will crash the UK out of the Union with no deal by the October 31st deadline, an option many warn would cause economic chaos and a British recession. Political analysts, however, expect Johnson to renege and accept some alternative. With his record of double talk, About turn and mendacity, says the Guardian's Simon Jenkins. Johnson can be relied upon only to deliver something other than what he promised. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. The first is Why GOP Officials Are Quitting. A contagion has been spreading through the House Republican caucus, said Matt Ford. In just the past 2 weeks, seven incumbents have announced they wouldn't run for re-election in 2020, making it 11 so far this year. The biggest blow came when Texas's Will Hurd joined the exodus. Often described as a future star within the party, Hurd, the lone African-American Republican in the House, is a moderate who represents a border district that is heavily Hispanic. In explaining why he's leaving, Hurd included a strong criticism of the GOP's current direction, saying, "Every American should feel they have a home in our party." Under President Trump, that is undeniably no longer true, as he writes off people of color, educated women, and diverse suburbs, and seeks to appeal solely to rural, mostly working-class whites. More House members are expected to retire. They are tired of having to turn a blind eye to Trump's divisive rhetoric and erratic behavior, and know that if they don't, they will be attacked and driven out of the party for disloyalty. This is not a sustainable dynamic. As long as Trump's worldview dominates the GOP, the party will continue to shrink. The realistic solution to climate change. Pseudoscientific hysteria is the wrong answer to climate change, said Bjorn Lomborg. Democratic presidential candidates are sounding warnings that if the U.S. doesn't dramatically cut carbon emissions by 2030, it will be too late and the world will become a hellish dystopia. Climate change is a real problem, but efforts to get rid of fossil fuels have largely failed. Of the 194 signatories to the 2016 Paris Agreement, just 17 are meeting their modest self-assigned targets. Why? Policies to cut carbon are incredibly expensive. The annual cost of promises in the Green New Deal, for example, would total about $2 trillion, or about $6,400 for every American. Activists think the only way to sell these costs is by scaring people silly, but it's not working. A new poll found that nearly 7 of every 10 Americans oppose spending just $120 each year to combat climate change. The only pragmatic way to address climate change is to pour resources into energy research to drive down the price of existing renewables and create new energy technologies. When the alternatives become cheaper than coal and oil, everyone will switch. It is innovation, not hysteria, that will win this battle. This is an international How They See Us column. It's titled Inciting Terrorism Against Mexicans. The carnage in El Paso was inevitable, said Leo Zuckerman in Excelsior from Mexico. Donald Trump came to political prominence by questioning the citizenship of then U.S. President Barack Obama. Trump launched his own presidential campaign in 2015 by slandering Mexican immigrants in the U.S. as criminals and rapists. In office, he has demonized Muslim lawmakers and Central American asylum seekers. It is no accident that his racist and xenophobic speech has empowered white supremacists like the one who killed 22 people at a Texas Walmart last week. 8 of the victims were Mexican citizens, including Elsa Mendoza Marquez, 57, a schoolteacher from across the border in Ciudad Juarez. Thanks to President Trump, white nationalists are no longer in the catacombs, but present in the public arena. Trump sows hate at his rallies, encouraging the mob to chant against illegal immigrants. At a rally in Florida in May, he even laughed when a supporter suggested shooting migrants. No one should be surprised when someone actually opens fire on Hispanics. Mexico is treating this as an act of terrorism against our citizens, said Roberto Gil Zuarth in El Financiero in Mexico. It wasn't just another American mass shooting. The killer drove some 650 miles from his home outside Dallas to the border city of El Paso, specifically to kill Mexicans, and he was spurred to this slaughter by Trump's hate speech. Our foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, says the government might seek the killer's extradition, but Mexico has no legal standing to do so. Instead, we need to mobilize unprecedented international pressure against America's official racism. President Andres Manuel López Obrador has been too meek in the face of Trump's bullying, said Javier Lorenzo in El Universal from Mexico. A few weeks ago, he surrendered to Trump's demands that we send troops to our southern border to halt the northward flow of Central American migrants, or else be hit with harsh U.S. tariffs. It's time to restore strength and dignity to the bilateral relationship. Yes, we'll help tackle the migrant crisis, but only if the U.S. stops the trafficking of guns, the weapons that fuel cartel violence here. Some 70% of guns found at crime scenes in Mexico were bought legally in the U.S. and then smuggled here. Most importantly, there should be no cooperation on any issue unless Trump ends his racist rhetoric. He wants, said C.G. Worldman in the Sydney Morning Herald from Australia, Trump's entire political shtick is pivoted on the white nationalist notion that white Americans find themselves in a do-or-die struggle with non-white immigrants. He uses dehumanizing terms, calling Hispanic migrants invaders, and the El Paso killer echoed those terms. Remember when Rwandan Hutu politician called the Tutsi ethnic minority cockroaches, it started a genocide that resulted in the deaths of upward of 1 million people in that country. The U.S. is in the midst of a domestic white nationalist terrorism crisis, and the president is only fueling it. Our in-depth article, The Last Word, this week is titled, Don't Expect Me to Be Grateful. I am the kind of immigrant the haters think is uppity, said Suketu Mehta in the Washington Post. I've been told to go back more times than I count, than I can count. I won't. We're stuck with each other. And we'll be richer for it. In June, I published a book, This Land is Our Land, an immigrant's manifesto, arguing that immigration is a form of reparations. It drew forth a fusillade of hatred on Twitter in my inbox, under the rocks of 4chan and Reddit, suggesting that I return to India. One reviewer on Amazon called for me to be skinned alive and to go back to my third world country. Someone else tweeted, this cockroach needs sent back to whatever blank hole she crawled out of. Meanwhile, University of Pennsylvania law professor Amy Wax, in a speech at the National Conservatism Conference, said I had argued that immigrants should not join the mainstream or try to preserve and protect what makes America great, but should just take over from the white power structure. I've said no such thing, of course. Wax accused immigrants like me of being culturally inferior. Most inhabitants of the third world don't necessarily share our ideas and beliefs. Our country will be better off with more whites and fewer non-whites. I've been told to go back ever since 1977 when I enrolled in an extravagantly racist all-boys Catholic school in Queens, New York, birthplace of President Trump, who recently became the biggest, loudest mouthpiece for this line of rhetoric when he tweeted that four congresswomen of color should go back to the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. The idea is white Americans get to decide who is allowed to come in and what rules we are to follow. If you come here, don't complain. Be grateful we took you in. Go back is a line that's intended to put immigrants in our place, or rather, to remind us that our place in this country is contingent, that we are beholden to those who came here earlier. To this I say, no, we are not. I take my place in America, an imperfect place, and I make it my own. There's a constitution that protects my right to do so. I will not genuflect at the white American altar. I will not bow and scrape before my supposed benefactors. I understand the soul of this nation just as well, if not better, than they do. A country that stole the futures of the people who are now arriving at its borders. A cacophonous country, an exceptional country, but one that seems determined to continually sabotage its journey toward a more perfect union. Nobody powerful ever gave the powerless anything just because they asked politely. And immigrants don't come hat in hand. I am an uppity immigrant. I am entitled to be here. Deal with it. Should today's migrants be grateful to the countries that caused them to move in the first place, the ones that despoiled their homelands and made them unsafe and unlivable? For example, in Somalia, birthplace of Representative Ihan Omar, the United States sent $1 billion to the dictator Mohamed Siad Barre, and the ensuing civil war quite literally blew up Omar's childhood. She should be grateful that her family had to escape their land and their people and live in a tent in a refugee colony for 4 years. Representative Rashida Tlaib should be grateful that her parents had to leave the West Bank and seek shelter in the country principally responsible for backing and sending billions annually to the government that occupies their hometown. Central American immigrants, too, should be grateful to the United States. An American banana company, for instance, owned 42% of all the land in Guatemala. And for decades, Washington replaced democratically elected Latin leaders with dictators more malleable to its will. Now, at our southern border, we turn away people seeking asylum from the consequences of these policies. The West has despoiled country after country through colonialism, illegal wars, rapacious corporations, and unchecked carbon emissions. And now their desperate migrants are supposed to be grateful to be let in by the back door at the mansions of the despoilers, mansions built with the stolen treasure of the migrants' homelands. It's not exactly all wine and roses for the immigrants who get to America either. Never in my 42 years here has anti-immigrant sentiment run so strong. For many immigrants, particularly the skilled ones, America is just one of many countries vying for their attention. But once people get here, they find a broken healthcare system, some of the worst infrastructure in the developed world, mediocre urban public schools, and a judicial system of mass incarceration that disproportionately targets its poorest and weakest. They find a culture where people don't respect their elders and where a successful life is prescribed by people like Amy Chua as the gaining of money and position. Most of all, they experience a profound, pervasive sense of alienation and loneliness in a culture where people live behind closed doors and don't know their neighbors. Immigrants can address these problems. We do not come empty-handed, mine host. We are businessmen, infantrymen, doctors, lawyers, elected officials, artists. My tribe, Indian Americans, has the highest average income and educational achievement of any group in the country. My family moved here in the 1970s, and America is better for it. So I claim the right to reside here by manifest destiny for myself, my cousins, and uncles and children's. For this, I am told that I don't know my place. Don't I? Having come here, I've stayed because I fell in love with America. It was a passion that started the summer after the fourth grade in Mumbai, when I first read Huckleberry Finn. 5 years later, I lit out for the territory, as Huck says. I moved to America. I am in love with the profound emptiness of the high desert on the California-Nevada border, a sense of space I have felt nowhere else. With what Hemingway did to language, prose that freed mine from English circumlocution and ornamentation, with the humor of Seinfeld and the exquisite sadness of Miles Davis' flamenco sketches, with the neighborhood of Jackson Heights, Queens, where I grew up in a building in which people who had been killing one another just before they got on the plane were now sharing foods, their kids dating each other, with the families of the victims of a 1991 massacre by a Chinese foreign student at my alma mater, the University of Iowa. These families, a month later, invited all the other Chinese foreign students over for Thanksgiving dinner because they wanted to show the demagogues if they didn't hold a grudge, no one else should. With the people of Raleigh, North Carolina, who elected my brother-in-law, Jay Chaudhuri, to the state senate, a brown-skinned man running against a white opponent in a district that's 82% white, with the scrum and tumble of robust political debate, this messy mix, this redneck's rondeau, this barbaric yawp, for these and a thousand other American excellences, I am not so much grateful as I am deeply, head over heels, in love. As I am in love with many things about the country of my birth, India, or other places where I have lived, the green hills of England, the lights along the Seine in Paris, the samba bars of Brazil, I am grateful to those countries and their people for showing me their wonders. The earth, it is a marvelous place. To the 64% of Americans who've never left the country, you should try it sometime. This beautiful blue-green oasis in the universe belongs to all of us. But in all my travels, I never thought I could be English, French, or Brazilian the way I can be American. I don't know if an American who moves to India can truly feel Indian. I love America most of all because it is a country made up of all the other countries. This is the American exceptionalism. This is what I will fight with all my power as a writer to defend. I will never let anyone, least of all a racist, failed businessman and television huckster, son of a slumlord from Queens and an immigrant from Scotland, define my Americanness. I am an American, Kolkata born. I will call my adopted country loudly, with all my strength, to account, as in my last book I called India to account for its shabby neglect of its cities and rampant political violence. This is part of the obligations of citizenship, as well as the covenant of my guild. As the Czech poet Jaroslav Seifert noted, for anybody else, staying silent can be a tactical maneuver, but a writer who stays silent is lying. We are all Americans now, for better or worse. My critics may not like my being here, but they're stuck with me, as I'm stuck with them. Trump is stuck with Omar, as she is with Trump, and they're both getting paid to move the country forward. How do we work together? Those who came before will have to make space for those who are coming now. Both will become richer in all senses of the word. There is hope for this more perfect union if you know where to look. The Jackson Heights Jewish Center, a conservative synagogue, has hosted Passover celebration and bar mitzvahs since immigrant Jews moved to the neighborhood in the 1920s. These days, there aren't as many Jews in the area. They prospered and moved to the suburbs. So the center now offers services for many religions, including Islam, and the space echoes with verses from the Quran, honoring the God that all the children of Abraham worship, and resonates with Pentecostal and Hindu chanting. The clash of civilizations is heard all the time in Jackson Heights, and it makes a joyous sound. We should all be dancing to its beat. This article originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read a couple of the health and science articles this week, starting with Fighting Sickle Cell with Gene Editing. Doctors in the U.S. are using CRISPR, the pioneering gene editing technique, in a landmark effort to treat a debilitating and often fatal genetic disorder. The experimental treatment, a first in the U.S., is for sickle cell disease, a disorder that affects 100,000 Americans and causes problems with a protein called hemoglobin. The defective hemoglobin makes red blood cells hard and sticky, preventing them from carrying enough oxygen around the body. Sickle cell sufferers, most of whom are black, can experience intense pain, organ damage, and blindness. Many don't live beyond their 40s. For the CRISPR treatment, scientists extract young cells from the patient's bone marrow and modify them to produce fetal hemoglobin, typically made only by fetuses in the womb. Patients undergo chemotherapy to kill off cells carrying the genetic defect, and then have the CRISPR-edited cells reintroduced into their body. Doctors at the Sarah Cannon Research Institute in Nashville have already completed treatment on the first patient, 34-year-old Victoria Gray. They hope to enlist 44 others in the U.S., Canada, and Europe. The experiment is at a very early stage. It'll take several months before doctors can tell whether the new cells are producing the hemoglobin, and longer still to determine if the patient's health has improved. But that's not a problem for Gray. "This gives me hope," she tells NPR.org, "even if it gives me nothing else." A warm bath for better sleep. Having a warm bath before bed could improve your night's rest, a new study suggests. Human body temperatures vary throughout the day in line with our internal body clocks. About an hour and a half before we usually nod off, our bodies cool down by around 0.5 to 1 degree Fahrenheit. Researchers at the University of Texas at Austin suspected that exposure to warm water could stimulate the body's natural thermoregulatory system, enhancing that crucial cooling process. To explore this idea, they examined 17 previous studies that looked at the effects of water-based passive heating, baths, foot baths, and showers on sleep. That meta-analysis showed that having a bath or shower of between 104 and 109 degrees Fahrenheit 1 to 2 hours before bedtime was linked with noticeable improvements in sleep quality and overall sleep time. Those bathers also took an average of 10 minutes less to drop off. Study author Shahab Haganyake emphasized that there is a Goldilocks-style sweet spot, reports CNN.com. A cold bath or shower encourages the body to warm up, making it harder to sleep. Having a warm bath too close to bedtime, meanwhile, has no soporific effect. And we have just time left for some of our shorter notes. We'll start with July was the warmest month the world has witnessed since record-keeping began more than a century ago, reports the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service. This July's global average temperature was 1.01 degrees above the 1981 to 2010 average. Of the 10 states with the highest poverty rates, all but one, New Mexico, are in the South, and gave the majority of their votes to Donald Trump in 2016. The Northeast, the region with the lowest poverty rate, voted against Trump, with the exception of one electoral vote in Maine. Two California professors have installed three pink seesaws across the U.S.-Mexico border wall, running between Sunland Park, New Mexico, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, allowing children on both sides of the border to play together. Ronald Rael of the University of California, Berkeley, one of the designers, said the teeter-totter wall vividly illustrates that actions that take place on one side have a direct consequence on the other side. The Trump administration has extended temporary protected status for 7,000 Syrian refugees living in the U.S., but the administration is pushing to revoke that status for tens of thousands of people from six countries who were admitted years ago, including Salvadorans, Hondurans, Nicaraguans, Haitians, and Sudanese. On the poll watch, 22% of millennials say they have no friends, and 30% say they always or often feel lonely, higher than any other generation. 16% of Gen Xers and 9% of baby boomers say they don't have any friends. And we'll finish with a quote from T.S. Eliot, who says, "The years between 50 and 70 are the hardest. You are always being asked to do things, and yet you are not decrepit enough to turn them down." And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.